Chapter 2. Tommy. Of a fight with a canvas bag, and other matters concerning retribution for adventures too numerous to mention. I was the first one to go. Part of me didn't want to do it, but we were all partying too hard. So we made a pact, and being a team player and shit, I checked into rehab first. I wasn't as bad off as Nikki or Vince, but I was drinking like a maniac, smoking weed, and every once in a while I'd fuck around shooting heroin with Six. That drug was so fucking good it scared me. I didn't think I had any problems, though, until I checked into this place in Tucson called Cottonwood. There was this doctor there who brought all this shit to the surface that I had never even really thought about. On my second day there, he made me sit in a room while he stood behind me. There was nothing else around except for an empty chair across from me. The doctor said that I should look at the empty chair and imagine that my addiction was sitting there. Then he would say things, and I was supposed to imagine that it was my addiction speaking to me. It seemed stupid at first, but after a while I started to believe it. "I know you love me," my addiction said. "You think about me all the time. You can't live without me." Suddenly, all this anger came to the surface, and I jumped up and freaked out. "Wait a minute," I yelled at the empty chair. "Fuck you. I can fucking live without you." "That's good. I want you to talk back to your addiction," the doctor said. "I want you to get mad at it. I want you to destroy it. It is not your friend. It is your enemy." Then he replaced the chair with a heavy canvas sack and handed me a fucking baseball bat. I ran over and started beating the shit out of this fucking addiction sack, dude, and full-blown tears were flying out of my face. "Show it how you feel," the doctor kept egging me on. "It wants to hurt you. Get it out of your life." I kept going crazy on the bag while bawling like a baby. It was like an exorcism, bro. I'll never forget that fucking experience because I realized that there was some other force that had been controlling me for years, and it was the first time I had communicated with it. I didn't know until then how powerful that force was and how powerful it wasn't. Addiction is only as strong as you let it be, and I had let it become too powerful. There was a sign on the wall at Cottonwood that said, "Silence equals death." And I'll never forget that phrase because it made me think of my childhood. My parents were always cool, but whenever I did something wrong, I was punished with silence. They'd send me to my room, and when I asked what I did wrong, they wouldn't speak to me. So I'd sit in my room wondering what the fuck I did and why no one would talk to me. My parents thought that was how they were supposed to teach me a lesson. So from an early age, I equated silence with punishment. When I became older, nothing would piss me off more than someone not talking to me. It still fucking gets to me if a girl doesn't call back or if I do something wrong and get the silent treatment from a friend. Dude, I want to crawl into a hole and die every time. So when I saw that sign in rehab, "Silence equals death," I said to myself, you know what? That's exactly what it fucking felt like as a kid. Everyone in the band was in a different program, but after a week or so, Bob Timmons thought that we should be together as a group, so they all flew down to meet me. We stood in a circle with some other people in the clinic, put our arms around each other, and sang, "You can't always get what you want," which was probably the perfect message for a band like us because we were all so used to getting exactly what we wanted whenever we wanted it. The spigots controlling my eyes turned on again, and I turned to Nikki and sobbed, "Isn't this the most beautiful song, dude?" And he looked at me like I was crazy, then looked at Mick and whispered something about me falling for this Jim Jones shit. I don't think anyone in the band ever took me seriously. I was seen as the puppy dog whose paws were too big and always tripped over everything. But then, after singing, we all sat down. The counselor asked us to visualize ourselves as little boys, and all of a sudden, Nikki broke down. His face turned red, and he was so choked up he couldn't speak a word. Later, he said that he visualized himself at one end of a street with his mother at the other end, and he realized that all his unresolved bitterness and resentment toward his mother and father were still haunting him. If I was the goofball that they were learning had a genuine sadness behind the mask, Nikki was the madly charging ram who we learned had a tender spot where real feelings and emotions lay. Even Vince, the most impenetrable of us all, began to open up and cry. For the first time, I saw a weakness in Motley Crue that I had never noticed before. We all turned into broken-down little children, except for Mick, who was being strangely stubborn and refused to open up. Every time we sang together or meditated or went through any exercise to get in touch with our emotions, I'd look at him, and he'd have an expression on his face like he was about to vomit all over the floor.